From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We want to warn you today, right from the top, that we will be talking about sex, sexual assault, difficult issues of consent, coercion, and more. And this material might not be suitable for children or all listeners. Our connection this hour was made when a young man was suspended from college after an allegation of sexual misconduct. These days, that sounds straightforward enough, but as Radiolab reported, it was anything but straightforward. The man went back to a dorm room with a young woman he had met. They engaged in sexual activity. She even told him yes when he made suggestions about what activity to engage in. But later, upon reflection, she decided that she not only regretted the sexual activity, she decided that her yes was not genuine, and the incident was actually a case of sexual assault. And now consider another account that Radiolab covered. A young woman brought a guy back to her room, initiated an encounter that included oral sex. The woman removed his clothing and seemed to be the initiator throughout the encounter, but there was never a conversation, never a verbal yes or no. And later, she regretted performing oral sex. The young man was sanctioned, and he was told that technically, she had not given consent. They hadn't talked about it. This month, Reason magazine details the story of journalist Jonathan Kamen, who lost his budding career after two women accused him of sexual assault. The first woman described an encounter in which she went home with Kamen. They got into bed together, but she decided she wanted to stop. She says that he pouted a bit and then tried to talk her back into sex. She decided to resume the activity, but the next day she wished she had not. She came to the conclusion that she had been coerced and, quote, "What happened was not my fault, and I do not share the blame," end quote. And now the Washington Post's Megan McArdle takes aim at affirmative consent, the idea that throughout a sexual encounter, partners should consistently check in to get approval for what is happening. McArdle writes that it's not working, and it's not realistic. She writes, quote, "We're not arguing about whether people should be attuned to their partner's level of interest in the activity at hand. We're arguing about whether the law should call it rape if you didn't get affirmative consent at every step of the game. So while you, sensible supporter of affirmative consent laws, may say, we're not actually proposing that people stop every 5 minutes to ask, is this still okay? Once it is codified as a rule, your sensible proposal will have the practical effect of forcing just that. And in fact, if you read up on affirmative consent, you will find that this is, in fact, how these rules have been used in practice." End quote. McArdle concludes, quote, "Campus tribunals shifting the burden of proof to defendants who cannot possibly meet them because there is no way to ever establish that during every second of an encounter you had affirmative consent," which is the problem with positive feedback. There is no safe harbor, no way to ever know that you still have consent, even if you asked 5 seconds ago. You'd have to say, what about now? What about now? End quote. So is McArdle right? Is affirmative consent a failure in practice? Or are they misunderstanding how it's supposed to be working? Our guests this hour include Allison O'Malley, the Chief Executive Officer of Resolve. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Lauren Berger is an Education and Outreach Specialist at Restore. Nice to have you back here. Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
I'm going to start with a couple of little notes on background. I was asking our guests before the hour began, when the phrase affirmative consent effectively hit the American mainstream, Allie, you were saying really 2015. It really is that brief, that recent.
Correct.
Do you take these critiques and say, do you agree at all that we need to stop and say it's not working? Do you view it a different way? Is it working?
Well,
it's probably a complicated question.
It's a really complicated question. I think that there's a difference between affirmative consent and how it's employed on college campuses than it would be in more of a general court of law. And while consequences on a college campus, while they are attempting to navigate some of these complicated cases, appear to have very, very significant consequences to the perpetrator, it's a process that we can need to continue to unravel. So there really isn't a simple answer here. I think that New York State in particular has tried to do the right thing with affirmative consent, but there does need to be greater definition of how to actually, I don't want to use the word adjudicate, but that's what's happening on campuses, is they are conducting hearings on campus, mm-hmm, to understand whether or not conduct has been violated.
Okay. Lauren, you think it's working?
I, I think there's a lot to unpack with all of these big abstract policies that we try to apply across 50 states and thousands of campuses and the way that they actually flush out an application. In New York State, just as Ali was saying, you know, we've done a lot of work toward defining that affirmative consent and working it into a structure where students can be held accountable for violating a student code of conduct that defines affirmative consent as yes means yes. But it does cause confusion when students who may have a conduct case choose to report maybe outside that system toward a police officer or within, you know, sort of the criminal justice penal code, and they're not defined the same way because enough is enough. This New York State law that employs affirmative consent on college campuses is an education law that has its governing body from the student code of conduct and not New York State criminal penal code. So when folks are trying to apply justice measures in these different realms, the definitions aren't the same. And so there is a lot of that confusion and things kind of intersecting where the systems are not built to deal with some of those issues, not only regarding affirmative consent, but in interpersonal issues where the law may offer a very black and white articulation of a transgression of that law and what an appropriate consequence is. But with human interpersonal interaction, it's very rarely a black or white, or what people often say, you know, there's 50 shades of gray. And with that in mind, it's very hard to articulate and nail down for a policy standpoint what we're going to be able to actually affirm, what we're going to be able to actually use as a structure, and how that's going to work. So in some ways, enough is enough in 2015, passed by New York State, was a venture in articulating that and clarifying that. But the policy of affirmative consent rests upon people being able to articulate the kind of sexual activity they want to have. And in large part, that foundation has not been built in New York State or in many other states.
Caitlin Flanagan is a writer who was on Sam Harris's podcast, and she made exactly the point that Rosenfield and McArdle have been making in the last week. And there are a lot of voices making this point, and I want to ask our guests directly if they agree with the point or if they think it's more nuanced than this. The concern that Flanagan and others have expressed is this. There is something either hypocritical or dissonant about telling women in particular, you have agency, you have choice. Sex isn't just something for you to give up and men to get. It's something for people to experience together, gay, straight, otherwise, that you have the agency of your choices, that you can be empowered. That message is one thing. But they think there's a dissonance or a hypocrisy to then say, hey, you know, women, think about this. You know, that sex that you regretted, you know, maybe you were actually assaulted. Maybe you were coerced into it. Maybe you never really gave consent, even if you weren't physically forced to do anything. And their point is they think that removes agency. And the reason they bring it up is because they think that's not an outlier. They think this is happening more frequently, or that culturally this is a message that young women in particular are hearing. Do you agree or disagree, Ali?
Yeah. I wish it was as easy as agree or disagree. I'm going to share a brief experience. So when I was working on college campuses during 2015, 2016 with the affirmative consent idea and trying to educate students about that, I'm 50 years old. And when I reflected and developed curriculum to think about how do you prepare students for a yes means yes compared to a no means no conversation, it was challenging for me just having grown up in a different time and instructing young people about the agency over their bodies, the importance of that agency, and mutual respect. Because growing up when I did in the 70s and 80s, women were just conditioned differently. And there is what was often considered rite of passage for us in the 80s and 90s even, is not rite of passage anymore. You have much more say now. Culturally, we're still not there.
Can I, for a second, when you say rite of passage,
yeah,
can you be a little bit more specific?
Yeah, although I, you know, certainly growing up in the 80s and 70s and 80s, I learned that women can have it all. But the actual enculturization of that, it was not consistent. So women's bodies were still considered playthings for men in my generation.
So a rite of passage was that you're going to have a sexual experience that feels off or
yeah,
wrong.
But, right.
You know, that's what men do and that's what happens.
Yep.
Okay.
Exactly. So I think that some of this, the process of educating and embracing this idea of agency is really deeply rooted in our culture. And it's challenging to overcome. And I struggle with kind of remorse after the fact. Geez, I didn't like that now, and I want to do something about it. I think there is a personal responsibility piece that we bear in affirmative consent. It's mutual responsibility. And sometimes we make choices we're sorry we made. It doesn't mean that we should pursue some sort of recourse.
A legal action?
A legal action. Most of this action is not in a legal sense. It may be only within your campus or only within your business organization. So I think there's many, many strengths in the notion of affirmative consent, but it's something we have to embrace at a cultural level more than in a codified way.
Okay. How do you feel about that, Lauren?
I think Allie brings up a lot of great points, this idea of knowing something and yet in cultural application, maybe not so much. And this idea of students coming onto a campus in college at age 18, most of them, and having not a ton of information on what that actually means in practice. Like maybe we learned it in an abstract sense, but not so much in terms of application, that not only is it both parties' responsibility to acquire affirmative consent, but that we can have sexual activity that is about pleasure, and that that's not often a component in sex education if students have comprehensive or worthwhile sex education at all.
Is that changing? Is that changing now?
It's tough to say. I think in a lot of public schools, it's still very a fraught subject in terms of sex ed in general, and it mostly centers around pregnancy prevention and sexually transmitted infection prevention. So that's mostly through a heterosexual lens. So already there's some components of sex education that are being missed. And in many ways, the idea of desire and pleasure gives people a very uncomfortable feeling when talking in middle and high school classrooms. So in a lot of ways, I think that that's a gap in learning. And then when you have students who have varying degrees of knowledge or experience coming on campus, they are going to have some of that crossover in coercion, regret, not sure, gray area, and there is little option for that recourse. And so affirmative consent policies allow one option in terms of a student conduct proceeding, but it also opens up the conversation for people to have other options, because most of the time when folks are assaulted, it's by someone that they know. It's by someone that they've met a couple times or as a friend of a friend, and not somebody that they want to see thrown in jail. And most students without an affirmative consent policy in a conduct proceeding would have no recourse. And often the only result that they want to see is they want to feel safe on campus. And so it may even allow for, in the future, other types of restorative justice or different options in terms of adjudication.
In reading and trying to kind of really think as comprehensively as I could about this subject before this conversation, it occurred to me that when we talk about coercion, too often we speak about it kind of monolithically. And here's what I mean by that. Now, I want to read a little bit about this in a moment, but here's my interpretation of that. I am deeply uncomfortable with anybody who would try to pressure someone into sexual activity because the person who's doing the pressuring just wants it selfishly. And unfortunately, just about everybody knows people who have been pressured or knows people, usually guys, not always. And again, I understand there's all kinds of different scenarios, but people who will do that. And I find that, number one, I find it really ugly and awful. And I'm sure there's probably times where it does cross a line that maybe even into a legal line. On the other side of that, the notion of coaxing or trying to convince someone to do something they may not want to do or maybe on the fence about, not every scenario would be the same. And here's where Rosenfield writes. She writes, "I'm not convinced that a world in which people are terrified to coax each other to do things, sexual or otherwise, is attainable or even desirable." And so here she makes two points here. She writes, she says, "We're okay with verbal pressure, coaxing in other settings, but not sex." So she says, you know, imagine you're at a party and you have a piece of cake and your friend says, oh, you can have another. Don't hate yourself. Just go ahead. And you don't really want one, but you sort of want one, but you really don't. And your friend says, have another. And then the next day you're like, I shouldn't have had that piece of cake. You're not going to be like, well, my friend, you know, coerced me into that piece of cake and now I want to press charges. But here's another scenario. She says, now imagine your friend invites you to a party and you demur. You say, you know, you're not really interested. And your friend says, you are so boring. No one likes you. No one likes hanging out with you. No, you never want to do anything. It's why you really don't have friends. Rosenfield says that would be manipulative and cruel, and you probably should sever that relationship. But if you go to the party as a result of that guilt trip, and the next day you wish you hadn't, you presumably would not accuse that friend of kidnapping you or doing something that crossed the law. They harangued you into it. They made you feel bad about yourself. It was pressure. It was manipulation. But you probably wouldn't look back and say, well, I was kidnapped. I want to press charges. You might say, I don't want to be with this around this person anymore. And what she's saying is, why is it different for sex? So Rosenfield takes probably the one extreme, saying you got to be very careful, and it would be have to take an extreme line in which coercion would ever actually be illegal. Whereas others say, look, there is a different category, and sex is different than having a piece of cake at a party or whether to go hang out with friends, and we've got to be very, very careful here. How do you view? I'll start with you, Allie.
Yeah, I think the two things are different. I think, and generally in the world in which I live, coercion is used always with the understanding that we're speaking about kind of sexual coercion. So I think when we throw that word around in inner circles, we understand what we're speaking about. I think the other forms of coercion are really about our human desire to belong. Like, we want to belong. We want to be accepted
and fit in some way.
Whether it's social pressure, like the party example, or just, you know, don't be so hung up about your weight all the time, eat the piece of cake.
Yep.
You know, like, so but all of these issues to me are really about how do we belong and how do we fit in and how do we come to see ourselves fitting in one way or another. So I think that having a distinction around sexual coercion is plausible. I don't know exactly what that looks like, but I do think that it's possible. But
and
I don't
and
think
rational?
You know, I think it comes, in order for it to ever be codified in any way, we have to start educating about it, to Lauren's earlier point. You know, we have to have language around sexual relations that we just don't have in this country. We don't talk about it. The education system talks about how to use the plumbing and the implications of using the plumbing. But we don't talk about being in relationships and what a healthy relationship looks like and that you can have a hookup and have it be an okay thing if it's done entirely by choice.
Yeah, and I think about the education side of it. You know, the no means no is again, as you talk about standards and phrases people remember, that's one thing. Now we're in the yes means yes, and you need the yes. So if you're in a sexual encounter with a partner that you've maybe been with for some time and you've gotten to know them decently well, I'm just creating a scenario. And you say, look, you know, I'd really like to have sex with you. And the person says, you know, I don't think I'm ready. I don't want to do that. And if you're thinking in your mind, like, look, here's the thing. I think you'd really enjoy it. I think you're nervous about it, or maybe you've had a bad experience with somebody else, or maybe I can really make you happy, and I think it could be a good thing for you. Is there something wrong, Allie, with continuing to try to change your partner's mind, to try to get a yes after you've gotten a no? Because part of what I think this national conversation that I've seen in the last week unfolds over is there is something that happens in a dialogue in which usually a woman will say yes and then look back and say, I really didn't mean that, or I didn't want to, or I felt pressured to. Is there a scenario where it's okay to say, hey, I got to know, but I'm going to keep working at this. I think my partner could really enjoy this, and I want her to enjoy this.
So in the scenario the way you outlined it,
yeah,
as long as there is an open and honest dialogue,
mm-hmm,
and there isn't a boundary being crossed in terms of, you know, I'm blocking you from leaving the room while we're having this conversation, or I'm holding you down while we're having this conversation. So there's a big difference between whether that's a conversation, the tone of that conversation, and whether you, as the party that's interested in engaging in sex, is being respectful of your partner. And you can have that conversation. That's part of negotiating as an adult or a young adult. But if the other person holds a hard line and says, I just don't want to, there has to be a respect of that, and then maybe you revisit it again in the future. But I do think that a lot of the yeses with regret come from this enculturization that says don't hurt a person's feelings. You know, women are told, don't hurt a man's feelings. You know, we are also told that men are fragile and you don't want to destroy a man's ego. So, you know, be careful about saying no. So while we're in this world of affirmative consent, we're taught from little girls to be careful about when we say no to men in a heterosexual relationship. So there's a lot that goes into what's happening in those conversations.
So one more point on this, and I'll turn to Lauren for her thoughts on that. What you just described, that look, you know, be careful about saying no. And we'll get to this a little later in the hour. We're not talking about physical violence right now. We're talking about men's feelings, losing a relationship. Will the man break up with you? Does he have a fragile ego? What women may be sort of socially taught.
Correct.
That is exactly the scenario described by the first accuser of the journalist, Jonathan Kamen. They go back. They are, you know, they seem, according to both parties, mutually into it at first. She decides after they get into bed, I don't want to do this. His description of it was he did pout a little, but he thought, hey, we're here. Let's have fun together. I'd like to try to change her mind. He did. He didn't force her to. He didn't say, you know, you're going to have any sort of consequence or penalty. But he thought, I thought we were into this. And they end up having sex. And she described it as he pouted. He tried to guilt me back into bed. And she said she ultimately decided that it was worth just giving in to his desire to have pleasure to kind of shut him up and get this over with. Mm-hmm. And the next day she wished she hadn't. And now she says she was not responsible for her own choice, that it was his, that he bears full responsibility for the sex, and therefore it was an assault. So I understand the dynamic that you describe. What I don't understand is, in her description, should that legally be considered an assault?
So again, getting into the distinction of legally or morally or otherwise, right? I would be hard-pressed, even in my position, to say on a jury that he was guilty of assault.
And we weren't there, and there's a lot that we don't know. But we're going by the two different accounts as best we can. But but go ahead.
So legally, she consented kind of regardless of her, whether or not it was meeting her needs. She decided that stopping him from whining and pouting met her need in that moment. And so she went ahead with it. You know, in a pre-Me Too world, I don't know that that particular story, the other one in that particular article might have come out. But in a pre-Me Too world, I don't think that that particular story would have come out. That one, that's a tricky one.
Yeah, and we're not seeking to denigrate any. I also feel like I have to make a distinction here as I turn to Lauren Berger on this. Some number of listeners are probably having the reaction of, boy, you're really fragile and you're really worried about men. And let me just say, when the pendulum has been on one side, imagine an actual pendulum. And if an equilibrium of justice is the pendulum is at the bottom and it's been loaded up to one side for so long, which it has, women in the workplace, women on college campuses, women in society. Number one, it's got to swing. And when it swings, it's probably going to go past equilibrium because that's what pendulums do. I am not more worried about it going past equilibrium than I was about the initial wrong in the first place. Me Too has been vital. I don't think that's controversial. This has to happen. We're spending some time this hour as we look at maybe ways to continue to constructively analyze how do we talk about sex? How do we even litigate allegations of assault? Where the lines are, because this is not someone broke your window and stole, you know, a wallet or a purse. This is the next day someone regretted something and doesn't know if they actually consented. That's much more gray. So I just hope it's not a, oh, here's another fragile man who's worried about men. I mean, I'm worried about everybody, but I'm not more worried about men than I was worried about the initial injustice. Having that, said all of that, what would you add to these questions about, you know, as we look at trying to make sure that the message does not become such that it removes agency or anything like that, Lauren?
it really just speaks to the myriad nuance around this issue and all the subsequent questions that come up after the first question, so to speak. So to speak back to the situation that you were articulating a few minutes ago, in that instance where you're describing this conversation of, you know, I think this could be really good for you, et cetera, and so forth, that seemed to be all that language and positioning was around how that activity could benefit your partner and bring you closer and be about connection and sharing with one another, which is in the land of affirmative consent, which we should all strive for, what we're getting toward with sexual activity for the most part, although folks can have various personal attachments to those activities, whatever they want. But it could be very different if the coercion is about, I want to do this, you should do this for me, if you really loved me. Mm-hmm. And there's a really big difference in how those conversations are positioned, even though none of us are going to be in the room and know, you know, what exactly was said, what exactly went down, and how that works. And it speaks to the possible gap in affirmative consent, meaning that the education law and in some ways the penal code through Enough is Enough and through other adaptations should they come down the pike in the future are seeking to address something that we don't have all the answers for. It tries to apply this black and white lens of adjudication and justice, etc., onto something that could have numerous other spider webs off of what's happening and allow other more nuanced, more personal ways to address this, such as restorative justice or in mediation or mm-hmm. other types of avenues, which in large part have not been incorporated into these things because the initial understanding was that this is an event that is so injurious and is so fraught, not only with the interpersonal aspects of everything, but that this subject of sexual violence and sexual activity in general has already impacted so many lives. And so the different sum of experiences that two different people bring into a sexual encounter are going to be very different. And some of them may need much more maintenance than someone else might assume.
That's a great point. I'm going to read some of the remarks sent via email from a guest who couldn't be here today, Morgan Levy, who is the Title IX coordinator and director of University Student Services for the University of Rochester. And here's what she writes. She says, affirmative consent requires that our students respect the fundamental idea that people have absolute autonomy over their body, that if you want to touch someone, you have to ask first, and they get to decide yes or no. It really isn't a complicated principle, and frankly, as Megan McArdle notes, if people aren't checking in with their partners, they probably aren't having very good sex. And Morgan goes on to say, I fear that in our social media, texting, Insta, Snapchat-driven world, we have lowered the bar on what should reasonably be expected in interpersonal communication. Having a conversation in person, using words and not emojis about what each person is comfortable with in a sexual encounter is a lot more comfortable than finding out after a sexual encounter that your partner wasn't into it. I also wonder how this perspective that using language to form a shared understanding about what is and isn't okay is too much to ask is really a somewhat veiled example of American prudery, that in our culture, we don't feel comfortable talking about sex in general. So having to say the words, can I touch your penis, or do you want to have sex now, is just taboo, end quote. So that's from Morgan Levy from the University of Rochester. A lot of nods over there.
Absolutely got some head nodding going on over here, short Morgan. And it sort of speaks to the earlier point about without the foundation of not only comprehensive sex education, but the component that your desire to feel safe is more important than somebody else's desire to have pleasure. And also the idea that you can have sex for pleasure and that your pleasure is a valuable component of what's happening is something that's lost on a lot of students before they get to campus. Mm-hmm. And that really skews the playing field in terms of what the encounters people are trying to do, especially if they're trying to navigate them through, as Morgan said, a series of emojis.
It's an amazing thing to think about because it wasn't even a thing when I was growing up. As we said, a lot has changed. Mm-hmm. What do you want to add to what Morgan Levy sent there?
One of the things that she said, I was nodding to, but I loved her particular point about conversing with your partner, you know, and young people today in particular do not have the relational skills that our generations had because they are so accustomed to short text messaging, you know, sort of half saying something to somebody and assuming that they know what they're talking about or referring back to some meme somewhere that is commonly viewed and understood by people. We have a job to do in teaching kids how to communicate, particularly about learning how to communicate about things that are gray, as Lauren has suggested. This isn't black and white territory. Relationships are hard work. And I think a lot of the attempts to create legislation around sexual assault stem from the notion of the boogeyman who jumps out and is intending to do you harm. And what we've learned over the years is that sexual assault is far more common in scenarios where we know the partner. And the fact that we don't know how to communicate contributes to a lot of the challenges.
So this is where last week on Twitter, for example, as part of an ongoing thread of conversation about this subject, a listener named Ben was making the point that in his reading of the situation, of the statistics, the national conversation, the culture, that if you're a woman and you're feeling like your partner wants to have sex, that you might feel like you better do it or otherwise you could get killed or assaulted. And that is a strong statement. Now, Rosenfield pushed back and said, come on, that's catastrophizing. But Ben was saying, you know, he's got real concern that, especially for the perspective of women, and again, we've been sort of framing this as just men, women, and I don't necessarily intend to do that, but some of the statistics on violence are pretty clear in that, that some women might feel compelled to say, whoa, how far did I get myself in here, and what happens if I try to get myself out? Realistic fear or not?
Realistic. It is realistic. And I think that to our earlier conversation about just generational differences, I remember sitting at the dining room table in my house with my father and him saying, if anyone ever tries to rape you, let them. Because if you don't, they might kill you.
Your
so
father said
my
that?
Father said that to me as a teenage girl. So he was not the father of the year, I will tell you. However, it was part of kind of that, so that message that if you have gone so far, you need to follow through, it's just ingrained. It is deeply ingrained in our culture. And Me Too and other things are bringing to light the problems with how deeply ingrained that kind of language and the scenario and the story that you cited of the woman saying, oh, he's already in bed, he's naked, I'm just going to have sex with him. Where does that come from? Because to a rational person looking in from the outside, knowing what we know today, that doesn't seem at all like a reasonable decision. But it doesn't come just from what's happening in the immediate moment. It's much more deeply ingrained than that. It's
the accumulation of the historical knowledge and experience.
Yes.
And that idea that for so long we have sort of encultured women and girls to believe that someone else's pleasure is more important than their safety.
Correct.
And so knowing all of that and having all of that historical pendulum swinging, as you were saying, and all of the different weight to that, I think speaks to how, in some ways, some might argue that the law is overcorrecting, and some of those trying to give voice to some of the different nuances that people might experience with this, because we know that all of those dynamics definitely do play a part in everyday encounters that are happening now, even though we have the added insight that it's not okay.
Listeners, we're going to get some of your feedback after our only break here. I've got some emails to read. If you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Probably a good time to remind you that we're talking about some things that can be a little heavy, maybe not suitable for children or all listeners, as we talk about sex, affirmative consent, sexual assault, where the lines are, what to do about that. We're having that conversation this hour with Allison O'Malley, the Chief Executive Officer of Resolve. Lauren Berger is Education and Outreach Specialist at Restore. And we'll get to your feedback after our only break of the hour. Coming up in our second hour, economics writer and professor Noah Smith has a warning. He says it is now too difficult to get rich in the United States. He says a lot of the paths to wealth have been closing. And that means a lot of Americans who used to think that if they worked hard they could succeed and build wealth now know they cannot. What are the implications for that, and what could change that? Next hour on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. James emails us to say the following. I really feel bad for my sons as they get older. Our males can be accused of sexual assault based on feelings of regret, even though both parties were consenting in the event. I'm by no means a supporter of actual sexual assault, rape, etc., of course, but I feel like this is taking it to a level where our sons need to be paranoid, even with their own girlfriends. That's from James. What would you say to James?
Well, I would say that I'm glad that he chose to share his thoughts, and I'm glad that he felt the comfort to do that. But that it's unfortunate when folks come away from a conversation about having the nuances of these conversations and why it's so important to have these honest, open communication, that people come away with that as though that's a bad thing. And this need to be over defensive and paranoid about the conversations that ideally we should be having all the time. Even when we're 3 and 4 years old, is it okay to give you a hug? You know, like even those types of norms shifting and changing might seem difficult for some people who have maybe not have had to think about that. For instance, if all of a sudden everywhere had ramps and we had to use stairs to go around the ramps, everyone would say, what's going on here? Because we hadn't had to think about that before. But that it's not necessarily the end of times as we know it to say that, hey, we've got to be more careful. We've got to have a second thought before we just say whatever we want to the person jogging by or touch someone's body because we find them attractive and we're in a club. Those should be moments where we're giving ourselves pause.
Okay, Allie? What would you say to James and parents who are worried about their sons?
You know, I think that this is an opportunity for parents of boys, and the conversation does need to be happening between parents of boys and their sons, as well as parents and their daughters. For too long, the sole responsibility for this has laid with women. And so it needs to be a conversation, to your earlier point about it's sex is something that guys get and girls give. So, James, I'm also glad that you raised that as a concern, and I would encourage you and any other fathers of sons listening to talk to your sons about what respect in sexual relationships looks like. And if they are aligned with you in that thinking, you're probably not going to have anything to be concerned about. The vast majority of women are not accusing men of rape, which is, I think, also a really important point to be made here. Women are not lying around waiting to accuse somebody of rape. Nobody wants to have this happen. So I think that's important to keep in mind, too.
Tricia writes to us to say, if a few good men go to jail or lose their careers, that to me is a worthwhile price to pay to fix a broken culture. That's from Tricia. Allie, is that a worthwhile price?
Oh, you know, I think when we consider how the pendulum is going to swing, there is the great possibility that sometimes good people are going to get caught up in bad situations. I don't know that I would go so far as to say that that is an acceptable price to pay, but this is going to be a process for us going forward, probably for the next several decades, to try to figure out how do we actually protect people in intimate relations. And begin to shift as a culture to understand what that really means.
Lauren, what do you think?
Well, I mean, we certainly don't want to advocate for people, entering the criminal justice system or going to prison or jail for things that they didn't do or for crimes of which they are not guilty. But we know that as American legalese tends to try to meet the problems that we see in society, we see on many fronts that there tends to be some overcorrecting or people that do get caught up in the snare of something that perhaps in someone's view went too far, and that it is possible we'd be remiss to kind of say that it would never happen. Mm-hmm. But hopefully those present more of an opportunity for us to add nuance to the conversation rather than throwing the book at somebody and again applying that black and white lens onto something that we've clearly demonstrated is not.
Yeah. What my mind goes to after reading Tricia's email is a couple of things. There's a writer who I really like named Rebecca Traister, who she has made some remarks that are somewhat similar to what Tricia has to say here, which is that if you really want to get to where things are much more just, that it's going to be messy. You know, there's not an easy, short path there, especially when it's been one way for so long. Mm-hmm. And I don't think Traister or anybody else is celebrating quote unquote innocent or good guys going down with this. But I think what she's saying is there may be essentially two choices, which is that the status quo, in which, my God, we know what that has been for a long time. And frankly, it's not like we fixed it overnight. I mean, there's still a massive problem. And then the notion of what justice is supposed to look like, which is going to inevitably have some non-zero number of sort of casualties or tragic stories of people who probably should not have been accused or should not lose careers. I don't think Traister is celebrating that. I'm not going to seek to speak for a great writer like her. I'd encourage you to read her. But I think that's largely what she's saying is, let's not freak out too much here when we're on the path towards something that has been a long time coming. The question really now is, can we get that pendulum somewhere towards where it really needs to be? How close are we? And is what we're talking about, is it working? So I want to get Carrie on the phone from Rochester next. Go ahead, Carrie.
Hi there. I was just following up on the prior caller's comment about being worried about his sons, mm-hmm. and just wanted to point out that the number of people who make false accusations of rape is so infinitesimally small when compared with the number of people who don't accuse mm-hmm. their rapists or their sexual assaulters. So I think it's kind of a non-issue at this point. I also want to remind people that we have a judicial system that gives benefit of the doubt to people who are accused. So someone simply saying you did something doesn't then ruin your life absent of any actual proof or evidence or other indicators that that accusation is correct. So I think the whole, oh gosh, men can't speak to women, we can't even walk out of our doors anymore without being accused, is kind of overkill. And it's kind of about men pushing back against being forced to police their own behavior instead of women making sure that we don't lead someone on or consent, but not really consent. You know, it's just a little far-fetched to me that that's a real issue in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah.
And I will take your comments off the air.
Carrie, thank you. So let me just jump in first, and then I'm going to kick it to our guests here. So on the subject of, you know, we still live in a system that has to evaluate evidence of claims, et cetera. Part of the concern about Me Too is that it has engendered this idea that there isn't always a full vetting. And in the case of, for example, the Jonathan Kamen, the journalist who lost his career, he was told by an association of journalists that he worked with in China that his side of the story was not going to be welcomed as testimony. They were going to make a decision without it. And he couldn't believe that. But that's what happened. He is literally living with his parents in Arizona now. He's lost his career. And so the concern is that you don't always get a chance to tell your side of the story. And the other part about, I think the people like James would say is, it's a really scary thing to think that you could wake up the day after a sexual encounter and be like, well, that wasn't great. I kind of wish I didn't do that. And then you get a phone call and say, just so you know, you're being accused of sexual assault, and you go, whoa, you know, we were both drinking. It was not really probably a great idea, but we both consented. And now that's what scares people like James. What Carrie seemed to be saying is this is not a big percentage here. Mm. Like that is an overreaction, she thinks, on James's part to what is a natural correction. And again, to kind of use that phrase, in a broken culture. Mm-hmm. And I understand Carrie's point, too. What do you think, Allie?
I think that it's so people on the outside of this issue looking in tend to always go to the court system and the presumption that people are innocent until proven guilty and that the court of law is going to require that. In the case of the journalist that you're speaking of, there was no litigation. There was no court case. In many of the college cases, there hasn't been an official court case or an official legal complaint made, but there has been a conduct complaint registered and then an investigation that follows on campus. What affirmative consent in the proposed kind of world of trying to figure out if we can make this a legal statute or codify it in some way is saying that we're going to take the word of the victim and then encourage, you know, or make it the burden rest with the accused to prove that it didn't happen. That's what's happening within organizations today, like this journalist mm-hmm. went through, and what's happening on college campuses. And that is a fundamental shift to how our legal system operates. The legal system always goes from burden of proof rests with the prosecution, the accuser, not with the one who stands accused. When we flip that, it challenges our sensibilities as Americans. And so parents who are concerned about their child getting kicked off of campus or getting kicked out of an academic program because they're coming to understand that the burden then rests with their son to prove that they didn't do what they stand accused of doing. It's very scary. So I do understand where James's concern comes from. But I think the reality is that there is still a very low number of people coming forward claiming rape and sexual assault when it didn't actually occur.
Yeah, that's Carrie's absolutely right, and so is Allie. When we look at the statistics of false reports of sexual violence, they mirror the national statistics of other violent crimes, and the studies can vary depending on what year and when they were taken and where. But the lowest number I ever saw was 2%. The highest number I ever saw was 8%. So it's very small number. But I would want to push back on the idea that we're not employing due process on college campuses. Restore has Title IX advocate, educator, coordinator partners at different schools and relationships as advisors for reporting individuals through the student conduct process. Mm-hmm. And all of our campus partners work very, very hard to employ due process and have advisors for the responding individual, the accused individual as well.
You ready for this? James just followed up with an email. Your guests have definitely educated me after hearing the response to my email. Valid points, and I wasn't viewing it from the perspective they explained. I do see it their way more so than before. I still have some parental concern, but I do understand better now. James, that is power. I really appreciate that. And by the way, I mean, I understand the fear that you have. I don't think you're being sort of irrational or unjustified in voicing it. And I'm glad that you emailed, and I'm glad that we're making progress together here. So I deeply appreciate that. Thank you. In Webster, this is John on the phone. Got to keep it a little tight. Go ahead, John.
Thanks, John. Thanks, everyone, for taking my call. Two things. This morning, a jury decided that a coach in Webster was not guilty of raping a student. Certainly the student was unable to give consent because she was underage. But it didn't take the jury long to find him not guilty. But he's stained for life. He'll never get another teaching job, as far as I can see, because on his record is accused of raping a juvenile but found not guilty. Everybody's going to say, well, how did he get off from doing that? I think his life is ruined. Second thing, what about the thousands and thousands of cases of young men and some cases, young women who have been raped by clergy. I was
by the clergy, you said.
Yeah. By the clergy, yeah. They didn't report those cases. And it's when they come to light now, after many, many years. I was sexually brutalized when I was 11 years old. And by the clergy in the north of England. And I never mentioned it until I was 51, to anyone. And there were hundreds of cases at the seminary school that I attended that finally came to light from that school. But none of us had gone to authorities. Most of us had never told our parents. We were raped, but it was never reported. Mm-hmm. So I don't see this idea that there are very, very few rapes that don't get handled properly. I feel for that coach.
Yeah.
32 years old. Thank you. I'll take any comments offline. Thank
John, yeah, John, much love to you, and I'm really sorry to hear that. And I can still hear it in your voice. I mean, I'll let Allie and Lauren jump in. Go ahead.
Yes, I'm first of all so very sorry for what you endured, and I just want to offer clarification around what we've been saying. There are literally millions of cases of sexual assault, particularly in childhood, that go unreported, much like your own. So there are so many people that are suffering. And it's this whole effort, this affirmative consent conversation is about how do we make it safe for people to come forward and report when bad things like this happen and have the people held accountable. So I'm hoping that this is a movement that's going to ultimately serve people like you and young children who were like you were many years ago. But as far as the coach goes, you know, employment applications say, have you ever been accused of a felony or charged with a felony, not accused with a felony? And he was not accused or charged. So he may very well be able to go to another community and find work. We don't know. And, you know, I'm if he truly did not do it, then justice was served today.
Mm. So I just want to echo the thoughts in saying, you know, it took a lot of courage and strength and guts to make that call and to share what you've gone through. And I just want to honor that courage and strength and recognize that policies like affirmative consent might offer another option for people who maybe weren't able to report. And hopefully in the future, we use cases of people who might have been harmed by the system who did not perpetrate that, an opportunity to center them in healing this harm as well.
John, thanks again. And again, much love to you and continued healing going forward. Allison and Lauren, thank you so much for your expertise and your time and sorting through what can be complicated, difficult issues. And this is an ongoing conversation. We will be back here discussing this and related subjects because this is part of how society sort of evolved. Thank you for being here, and thanks for the work that you do.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
All right, short break. More connections coming up.